Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. When the Nazi Germany collapsed in 1945, millions of people who had been fortunate enough to see the war found themselves struggling to survive the peace. Millions of civilians died violent deaths, and 1.4 million German prisoners of war died in captivity, and these deaths took place after the fighting had stopped. This morning, in this first hour of the show, we will look back to the final chapter of the bloodiest war in history as we talk with Giles McDonough about his recently published book, After the Reich. The subtitle is The Brutal History of the Allied Occupation. This book is published by Basic Books and has just come out recently. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest. He's the author of The Last Kaiser, The Life of Wilhelm II, and also Frederick the Great, as well as histories of Berlin and Prussia. He wrote a regular column in the Financial Times and also has written for The Times, The Guardian, and The Evening Standard, and he makes his home in London. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions, comments from listeners are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so that we can accommodate as many different folks as possible and keep the program moving along, but of course, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also do have that toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that. That is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. McDonough, hello.
Hello, I'm here.
Oh, well, thanks very much for talking with us.
We appreciate it. Great pleasure.
Just let's review the numbers here just for a moment. First, how many German civilians and soldiers were killed before, let us say, from the beginning of the war up to the point where officially the war ended?
Well, that's very hard to say. I think the figure that comes into my mind from bombing of German towns, a civilian death, is about 900,000. And the total figure of German soldiers killed out of about 11 million who fought in the German armies was about nearer 4 million than 3. Obviously, if you then subtract the number of prisoners of war who died after the end of hostilities, then you'll arrive more or less at your figure for the soldiers' death. Mm-hmm. And then you have to add on the figure of about 2.25 million civilians who died after the end of the war.
So that, if indeed these figures are correct, for the civilian deaths, more German civilians died after the war than during the war.
That is correct.
You know, this is something that I'm sure this story, if people hear more as they hear more and more about it, will find it certainly very disturbing. It is a chapter in German history that I'm sure that people in Germany know about. Now, they may not talk about it, but they know about it. This seems, though, a part of the history of World War II that, as far as we're concerned, those people who live in the United States or in Britain, I expect, this is not a story that we have heard before.
It is not a story that many people have heard. Now, I think there are probably various reasons for it. It's not a particularly glorious story from the point of view of the Allies. And also, I think you have to take the good reasons and the bad ones that the Germans don't talk about it very much except among themselves. There are plenty of accounts in German, but it is thought on sort of right-thinking Germans often don't think it quite right to mention it because the whole issue of victim status comes up. And many people, many Germans on the left or liberal Germans, would say that the Germans have no right to assume the status of victimhood.
I expect that as well in Britain, the United States, France, other places, particularly those places where the Germans occupied and where people died as a result, I imagine they would say the same thing. They would say, yes, it's true that the Germans suffered after the war, but you would have to consider that they inflicted great suffering, that many more people as a result of the German occupation died in Poland, vastly more people died in the Soviet Union. And so either I would imagine people saying, well, if they want to put it bluntly, they'd say, well, the Germans had it coming. Or if they wanted to soften it a bit more, they would say, well, let's weigh here the number of deaths and acknowledge the fact that more people died as a result of German brutality than Germans died as a result of any kind of brutality on the part of the Allies.
Yes, I think that's undoubtedly true. That, I mean, if you're going to sort of set up your scales of deaths, then the Germans, inflicted many more deaths than anybody inflicted against them. That is certainly true. It still comes out as a huge figure of deaths, though, I might add, that both in terms of the German army and in terms of German civilians. Mm.
Well, if you look at, say, those German civilians who died in these first few years immediately after the war, obviously here this was a country that was devastated by the experience of the war, and that people were starving. They didn't have food. They didn't have medical care. People maybe didn't have decent places to live. There would have been all sorts of reasons why people might have died. So one might ask the question, how many people perhaps do you think died because conditions were just that desperate? And how many people died as a result of, let us say, direct violence?
Well, let me say that the figures that we have aired relate to the forced migrations of populations from German regions that were annexed by other countries. So we are not talking there, and we're not including the figures for deaths related, for example, to the terrible winter of 46-47, or to malnutrition, the failure of the Allied conquerors, if you like, to provide adequate nutrition. We're not even including those figures in that tally.
Mm. Well, then, how of the people that died here, if we're trying to get at this question of who is responsible, if you look at, for example, what happened in the Sudetenland in Czechoslovakia, where people died or were driven out by the Czechs, that this can – you can't lay that at the door of the United States, Britain, French, or Russia. How much of this was the result of, in a sense, cruelty visited upon Germans by people that they had occupied? And in a sense, it was clearly and undoubtedly a matter of revenge.
Well, I think in the case, I mean, I'm not going to try to put myself in the role of a defender of Nazism. That's the last thing that I want to do. But I think in the case of the Czechs, it is a little bit as if the Russians on the one hand and briefly the Americans on the other hand are holding one arm each of the German people of Czechoslovakia, which represents a sizable minority of the population. Because you will remember that the Russians have occupied most of Czechoslovakia, but the Americans had also taken the western end, if you like, and didn't vacate it until December. So a lot of this brutality actually went on under the nose of the American occupiers, who had advanced that far under General Patton. On the other hand, it would have been impossible for the Czechs to behave like that had they not had the support of the Russians who'd occupied the rest of Czechoslovakia.
Mm-hmm. Well, that certainly does it indeed also raise this question about how much of this death was the result of score settling, again, by people who had been brutalized by the Germans, and where the Allies simply stood back and watched.
I think there was a large element of that, and I think then you have to ask, what sort of propaganda had been used on Allied soldiers to make them think that they could stand back and turn a blind eye to what was going on? And I think in most cases it was considerable. I mean, in the case of the Russians, they had experienced at first hand what had taken place in their own country. But there were, important propagandists at work, like Ilya Ehrenburg, for example. And even in America, there had been a lot of propaganda handed out to American troops, particularly with a view that lots of young Americans didn't actually understand why they were fighting the Germans. And I think there was a fairly large element of German Americans there who worried the military authorities by the fact that their loyalties might be divided.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting to, and one of the things that certainly I want to talk about is what was indeed the formal attitude of the governments of the Allies toward the Germans and toward this, you know, what was they told their soldiers about, if they told them anything about how they were to behave. I think in the case of the United States, it's particularly interesting that there was a change and that at the beginning, the soldiers were told the German people are your enemy. Stay away from them. Don't be nice to them. Don't try to make friends with them. Don't get involved with German women. And that there was a change at one point, and that had to do with the Cold War and then the interest of the United States in having the Germans think that Americans were nice and that the United States was a good country and they should be in the Western camp as opposed to perhaps being involved with the Russians.
Yes, I think there's a fair element of, well, it's a cynical element in that very soon the Americans and the British realize the real enemy is not necessarily this defeated and abject German people, but it's Soviet Russia. But there is, I think, probably a humanitarian element in that, too. I mean, I like to think that some of the, if this book has heroes, some of the heroes of this book are people like James Burns, the Secretary of State, well, he was quite a neglected figure in American history, or, of course, Lucius Clay, who's not a neglected figure in American history or even in German history, do ultimately, or quite rapidly, come round to the view that, hold on a moment, you know, these people have suffered as much as we need to make them suffer. Mm-hmm. And they do fight, in many cases, to relieve the Germans, and I think much of that is heartfelt.
How much resistance was there? And I'm talking here about civilians, but I suppose that there could have been people who were remnants of the military that met the Allies, as I think that people have this idea that as Allied troops moved into Germany, that there was some kind of organized underground kind of resistance to them, and that was an issue.
I think it was virtually non-existent. I think the Allies were expecting to see these famous werewolves attacking them in a form of a sort of guerrilla army that would carry on fighting to the last. And this is certainly what the Nazis had hoped for. But when it came to the point of defeat, when formally, a draconian discipline of the German armies in the last moments where many, many soldiers were being hung from trees for desertion or for any form of infringement of military rules, as soon as we reached the 8th of May and the German armies formally capitulate, then there is not a whiff of werewolf activity. And indeed, you know, the very few acts that are said to have been committed by werewolves are in dispute, like the killing of the mayor of Aachen, for example. It looks like now that that was just a settling of accounts and was not a formal act on the part of any werewolves.
Mm. Let me introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Giles McDonough. He has written a lot about modern German history, including the books The Last Kaiser, A Life of Wilhelm II, and Frederick the Great. He's also written histories of Berlin and Prussia and has authored a newly published book. It's just out. It's published by Basic Books. That is a history of the Allied occupation of Germany after World War II. And the title of his book is After the Reich. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. We do have someone here calling in from DeWitt County on our toll free line. Let's go there. Line number 4. Hello.
Yes, I just wanted to relate a story that shows what sort of atmosphere there was at the end of the war. My father had a friend who was also in the army in Berlin, and he came upon a extremely drunken Russian soldier raping a German woman in an alley and wound up strangling him with his bare hands and was subsequently quickly shipped out of the city.
Hmm. I don't know how you want to comment on that, Mr. McDonough, but
well, I think there is, for example, Brigadier Howley's book, which is a good sort of punchy account of these times, at the time of the Berlin airlift and that period. And there are numbers of stories about fights between the American occupying forces in Berlin and the Russians, and punch-ups and shootouts and that sort of thing. I think it happened fairly often. I think that it took a long time to control. The Russians had, after all, in Berlin, they'd had control of the whole city until May. And when the other allies came in, they were reluctant to go back into their own sector. And quite often they came into the other sectors and carried on behaving as they had up to May. And I think the caller's story is a wholly believable one, because there were many incidents of this sort.
Well, here, one thing that you certainly write about it in graphic and disturbing details is the extent to which both looting and rape was widespread in this particularly the immediate days and weeks after the entry, first of the Russians and then the other Allied troops into Germany. Particularly, it would seem, maybe as an American I'm grasping at straws here, but it would seem that the worst offenders were indeed Russian troops.
Oh, well, there's no question about that.
Although we can't say that the French, the British, and the Americans were entirely blameless, but it doesn't seem that they committed these kinds of acts anywhere near to the extent that the Russians did.
No, I think the figures are still quite shocking, because I think I've never been an army man, a military man, but if you let your soldiers rape, it's either because you want them to rape, or it's because your discipline as an officer is not sufficiently heeded, and therefore your soldiers will rape people. I mean, a good officer, I assume, will prevent his soldiers from raping. So it's an interesting question, that one. The figures for British military rapes I have never seen. Now, there may be one reason for that, which is that we're a very secretive country here, and that all courts martial during wartime are under 100-year rule, so the person who appears in court has to have been dead for 100 years before that file is opened. The figures for American rapes are there, and they're in the book. They reach a peak, and I think in about June 1945, when I think there were around 600 a month. There were some very dramatic, as you've seen in the book, incidents of rape among the French armies. But all this pales into insignificance beside the Russian tally.
They certainly, perhaps more than any, well, more than people of other nations would have had reason to be enraged consumed with the idea for revenge, given what the Germans did in Russia. More Russians died, I think, than anybody any place else. And certainly, as we've discussed, there would have been on the part of some people who either fought against the Germans or were occupied by the Germans some desire for revenge. I guess, again, one wonders just how much that plays a part here, and that it would be a force that would outweigh and overpower many attempts at maintaining military discipline.
Well, that begs a question. Obviously, we'd want somebody from the army to ring in here and tell us what they would think about the idea of their troops, even if they felt a justified desire for revenge, whether an officer commanding those troops would actually allow them to satisfy that desire. For me, it seems to be that, you know, that the officers in command have to look at this thing relatively impartially and actually say, hold on a moment, you're not going to have your fun. This is about carrying out a military strategy, and it's not about your seeking personal revenge. Yet at the same time, you do understand, but maybe not forgive. And one episode, I can't remember if I included in the book, where a Russian goes all over a small town in Silesia that was then part of Germany looking for a four-year-old boy. And when he's finally found one and killed him, he says that was in revenge for the four-year-old boy of mine that they killed. That sort of story, of course, is comprehensive. You can understand a story like that, but you want to know where the officer was that had control of this man, because this is not the action of a disciplined army.
It does seem that at least again here in this first days, weeks, maybe months, particularly after the right at the point that the Russians moved in and they were the first in, that the it was chaotic at best. You wonder just exactly how much control anybody could have had over what happened there, at least right at the very beginning.
To some extent, that's true, and it must be very difficult to control these huge armies and that sort of thing. But I would have thought that the basic discipline in the Russian army and the Soviet army, if they sought to control their armies, would have been quite good. And there were enough statements by Stalin and others to say that these acts of rape and other forms of brutality, down to downright murder of civilians, were tolerated as a means of a small reward to the Red Armies for having done so well and got so far. I don't think there was ever any condemnation at the top.
Yeah. You know, here in the United States, over the last, certainly, I don't know, maybe 5, even 10 years, there have been a number of efforts to document, to acknowledge, to honor the service and the sacrifice that Americans made who fought in the war. And just only the most recent example would be this multi-part documentary series that was produced by Ken Burns and has just run on public television. Given that, and I'm sure that in Britain the same kinds of things have been done, given that, I would imagine that some of the things that you write about in this book just don't sit very well with an awful lot of people, and they say that somehow it's at the best disrespectful of and at worst dishonoring of those people who fought and perhaps died in the battle against Nazism during World War II.
Yes, I don't think I have never in no way said in this book. I mean, it's already a long book, but you can't really write it at the head of every page. I will say it now that I think it was a just war, and that I think that we, the Allies, needed to go to war to defeat this monstrous tyrant. And to disarm Germany, as it was in 1945, led by Adolf Hitler, and to terminate these genocidal policies that he was carrying out in occupied lands. Now, I make no bones about that whatsoever. There's a limit, though, to the amount of times that you can say that in the course of a book like this. But yes, and I would take the point that some people would say that, look, this is a sideline. The important thing was to defeat Hitler. But a lot of the things that I have recounted here took place after the Germans laid down their arms. Now, there are rules and laws of war. Admittedly, rules and laws of war do change with times. But, you know, there are codes. They're in every soldier's little pocketbook. And when a German soldier, for example, lays down his arms, he is supposed to be treated as well as a member of his own army.
We have some other callers here. Let's talk with them next. We'll talk with someone in Mahomet. No, I'm sorry, that person changed their mind. Well, how about Gibson City? We'll go there. Line two. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
First of all, I want to thank you for writing your book, because I think we got to read our history and find out what happened, and maybe change your ways. And second of all, I guess I should let you know that I don't believe in violence as a way, and I think war is horrible. And I say this with a father that was in World War II and a nephew who was in the Air Force, and I don't love them any less because of that. But I know that my father did not agree in us going to Vietnam War. But I guess I'm getting off what I'm trying to say is that but your book of history and the violence, I think it may be, hopefully, if we really look hard, that we will try other ways besides war and violence. And also, the statistics show, if I'm right, that 90% of the casualties in war are civilians. And 34% of those, in a statistic I read from Gino Strada's book, Green Parrot, 35% of those are children under 14 years of age. Now, I'm a Christian, and I believe in nonviolence. And as a Christian, I think, you know, it's wrong to take these lives. And I just want to hear your comment. And I just want to thank you for your book and hope people learn from your book. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Right, well, it's very kind of you. I think probably the civilian casualties and deaths have increased in recent wars. Certainly they were much higher in the Second World War than they were in the First World War. I mean, I suppose if you went back sufficiently in time to something like the 30 Years' War, again, you would see a huge number of civilian casualties. But I think that the Second World War was notable among recent wars in that there was such a high number of civilian deaths. Now, that was also down to various genocidal experiments on the part of the Third Reich, which has added greatly to the number of people who died in the war. And I think that the more that we have used bombing and bombing of cities and destruction of cities, which didn't happen, say, in 18th century wars or 19th century wars to the same extent, the more we're seeing civilians unjustifiably killed in the course of wars.
All right, let's go next to Belgium, the community that's not that far away from here. Line number four. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for pointing that out about the people now who talk about Ken Burns' film and how they say that we are somehow, it is somehow disrespectful to the troops to show everything, warts and all, the good things, the bad things, because it's like so much, especially American history, means we're in America, we always gloss over the bad things, or you never hear about it.
Yes, I think that, I mean, obviously you don't want to lose your perspective on things. It would be wrong to write a book like mine without actually making it clear that Hitler was a monstrous figure who needed to be defeated. And if he could not be defeated by diplomatic means, then the only alternative is to go to war and defeat him militarily.
Yes. Okay. Thank you kindly.
All right, thank you. All right. We'll go on to another back here, someone local in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, I just want to comment back on the idea of a just war. Certainly, the genocide that was going on and all the atrocities of both the Japanese and the Germans at that time, the governments were horrible. But I think it's important to take a broader perspective, too, and go back perhaps to the First World War and then to the wars before that. They're all wars of empire, and our war in the Second World War was also a war of empire. And empires clashed in the Pacific, and the Second World War grew out of the First World War and the awful things that were done in the wake of that war. And so, in part, it was just to try to protect the Jewish population and other populations that were being murdered. But we didn't go to war with the Turks, and we don't take them on today because of what they did, and we don't step in with genocide. We step in when our empire is at risk. And so it's important to understand that fighting for a government and a government's war is very seldom just. Thank you.
Well, Mr. McDonough, you can comment on that as you like.
Yes, I think it's true. I think that wars are mostly fought for foreign political considerations, and I think the Second World War was one too. And it is interesting and perhaps regrettable to add that the question of the murder of the Jews scarcely gets a look in before the end of hostilities in 1945. As the Allied armies uncover the evidence of genocide, they put it to effect by using it as propaganda against the civilian population in Germany, by, as we say, rubbing their noses in it, and by using it to tell them that they're all guilty of what took place in Germany and in German-occupied Europe. But until, let's say, April, May 1945, there was very little talk of it officially, although quite a lot of people knew it was going on.
Well, just to pick up on one point, because I do want to talk at least some about the experiences of German soldiers who were captured, who were prisoners of war. One of the things you write about in the book is the fact that the German concentration camps, places like Auschwitz and Dachau and Buchenwald, after they were liberated, were kept open, and they, German prisoners of war, soldiers, were put there. Was that something that was a utilitarian kind of decision? It was there, they needed some place to put prisoners, and it seemed to be a natural thing to do? Or did they did the Allies see that as some kind of symbolic statement about what the Germans had done, and that it was more than just housing them, it was a more symbolic form of punishment?
I think there was an element of that, but I have to add that the first time I ever went to Sachsenhausen, which was a terrible concentration camp just north of Berlin, it was still occupied. The SS barracks that were attached to it, they often were attached to concentration camps, the SS barracks were still full of Russian soldiers. They were comfortable barracks there where you could put your own soldiers up. And here was a ready-made camp, secure, which you could drive the enemies of your occupation into very easily. And therefore, the Americans took over Dachau and made that the center, really, for their prisoners of war in Europe, and also for their trials of German war criminals. The situation is slightly different on the other side of the Iron Curtain, where notorious concentration camps like Sachsenhausen and Buchenwald were kept open as late as 1953. And although not as many people were killed there as they were by the Nazis, that doesn't mean to say that thousands didn't die there. Auschwitz was briefly carried on mostly for German civilians from Silesia, but to give one very famous example, the commander of Auschwitz, Hirsch, was hanged at Auschwitz, I think, when 46, 47. So it was carrying on for some time as a POW come civilian internment camp.
We're just a bit past our midpoint here. We have about 20 minutes left in this part of Focus. I have another caller. I do, again, though, want to introduce the guest, Giles McDonough. He is the author of a recently published book that looks at the history of the Allied occupation of Germany after World War II. After the Reich is the title of the book. It is published by Basic Books. He's also written a good deal about modern German history, including The Last Kaiser, and that's a life of Wilhelm II and Frederick the Great. He's also written histories of Berlin and Prussia. He wrote a regular column in the Financial Times, and has also written for The Times, The Guardian, The Evening Standard. His home is in London. And questions here are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have another caller here in Cumberland County, line 2. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call. This is a very interesting program. One thing that has confounded me about the latter stages of World War II, and perhaps your guests can comment on this, is why, given the immense brutality of the German war in Russia and their occupation of vast areas of Russia, why did so many Russians tag along with the retreating German army in the latter stages of the war? Would your guest be able to perhaps shed some light on that? Thank you.
Obviously not all Russians were very happy with the regime, and indeed there were quite considerable numbers of Russians in units attached to the SS, the so-called Vlasov Army. The Ukrainians, given half a chance, would certainly have supported Hitler in a major way had it not been, though, for National Socialism and its what seems now a most unstrategic idea of telling Slavs that they were subhuman and refusing to acknowledge help when it came their way. I remember a man who'd been a subaltern, a lieutenant in the German army, who was then very old, telling me that he'd gone as a troop commander into the Ukraine at the beginning of the German march into Russia, and the people came out of the villages offering bread and salt, the traditional Slavic welcome. And then he broke down in tears before me, a man about 80, and said, "And what did we do? We killed them." You cannot underestimate the ridiculous nature of ideology in this conflict. If Hitler had actually wanted allies among the Slavs, he might have been able to recruit even more people in Russia. And certain elements, obviously, of the Russians, as the caller says, were certainly happy to help Hitler if it meant the defeat of Bolshevism and the unseating of Stalin. Unfortunately, Hitler's ideology didn't really give them much credence.
Does that get at your question, caller?
Yeah, I think it did, yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, then, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. A major part of the book does have to do with this very chaotic period immediately after the entry of first the Russians and then the Americans and the British and the French into Germany. Once things, in a sense, settled down and the occupation became formalized and the country and the city of Berlin was divided into these sectors, each administered by one of the four nations, the United States, France, Germany, and the United States, France, Britain, and the Soviet Union. Did things, in a sense, settle down? Was the worst of this what happened immediately after the fall of the Nazi regime, or did the kind of things that we're talking about persist into the next few years?
Well, very largely they did settle down, but especially in the Russian zone, these things flared up again. There was a certain amount of realignment of territory because the British and the Americans had gone a bit further than they were supposed to, and therefore people calmed down a bit in these areas and then suddenly learned that the Americans were going and the Russians were coming. And, of course, when the Russians came, you know, they were raping again and the theft started again, and, you know, so that all flared up. It was quite a long time before an adequate scale of charges were drawn up for Russians who raped German civilians. I mean, it was a year or two before that completely petered out, and that the charges against rapists became so draconian that eventually the Russians stopped doing it. So there was an element of that. There was a considerable degree of chaos. I mean, you have to envisage a country where a huge percentage of the buildings were damaged, or if not plain destroyed, and therefore people were living through fierce winters without roofs over their heads and very, very low standards of nutrition. But very quickly, you see people becoming concerned about this, like the British publisher Victor Galanz, who was, though Jewish himself, was absolutely fierce with the British government over the levels of nutrition provided for the German people in the winter of 1946, for example. Similarly, you have ex-President Hoover coming across and writing a report to try and bring up the levels of nutrition provided to the German civilians at that time when there was very little food around and it was a perishingly cold winter.
Mm-hmm. You know, as an earlier caller mentioned, I think a lot of people will understand that that in many ways World War II and the rise of the Nazis is linked very directly to World War I and the conditions visited upon the people of Germany after their defeat in the First World War. When all of this was going on, were there people in the governments, the Allied governments, the United States and Britain and France, who said that if in future we want a stable Europe and we want Germany to be a viable ally for us, that we need to be careful about how it is we manage this post-war period.
Very much so, and I think that that was definitely in Burns' mind, it was definitely in Clay's mind. The more realistic people thought that way, and remember, even Stalin put it about, and there were posters put up all over the Soviet zone saying Hitler's come and go, but the German people, we never had any quarrel with the German people, our quarrel was with Hitler. So there was propaganda of that sort, and helpful propaganda of that sort on all sides after the war, perhaps a little bit less with the French, who tended to see that, you know, that their own zone was a little bit of sort of compensation. But certainly on the British side, and the Americans and the Russians all believed that was true. One of the heroic figures of the British occupation was Sir Robert Burley, who was then to go on to become headmaster of Eton, the public school, but who, as a headmaster, felt that what the Germans needed was re-education, not denazification. And the idea was to treat them properly, but to try and put something into their minds that would allow them to reason their way out of the way that they'd been taught up to then by National Socialist thinkers.
Hmm. Also, you've got to put this also in the context of the emerging Cold War. And again, to return to something I mentioned earlier, I thought it's really interesting if you take a look at how the attitude of the United States shifted and how what soldiers were told shifted from, as I said early on, this idea that they were told that the German people are your enemy, that you don't want to have anything to do with them. Certainly, you know, don't try to be nice to them. Don't take pity on them because they got what they deserved, to a different. So as you get to the point where we get into the Cold War, and we, as is very clear, there was a public relations battle kind of going on where now we wanted to win over the German people. And can you talk a little bit about what American soldiers were told and how they were expected to conduct themselves and their relationship with the German people, comparing the time, these two times, the sort of the earlier time and then the later time?
Well, I think that the American chiefs of staff had wanted it to be an absolutely heartless occupation. And increasingly, they saw the means of doing this. I think that after Patton visits the concentration camp at Ohrdruf, he gives out that all American officers should visit the concentration camps to understand why they're fighting. So the concentration camps, and they become this sort of macabre form of tourism eventually, that American senators and congressmen are actually coming to Buchenwald, and then, you know, a specific tour is laid on where they go and see the place where they go and see the gas chamber, and they go and see this, and they go and see that, and the shrunken heads of Ilse Koch and all that. But this very quickly does give way to another sentiment, and Patton is in himself an interesting case, because very soon Patton is saying, look, you know, these are good people. Maybe he thought they were two good people, but he said, you know, the real enemy is that one over there. And I think a lot of Americans thought that way, not just Americans. I think that probably in his heart of hearts, General Montgomery, Field Marshal Montgomery, also felt that way. And very, very quickly, so that you had, for example, I think 1 million or 2 million German soldiers relieved of their weapons, but their weapons were not very far away. And I think it wouldn't have taken very much for the British to have agreed to rearm the Germans and put them back to war again against the Russians. I think that it was something that the Nazi leaders had always hoped would happen. And pity for them, you know, it never did happen, because I think by that stage the Allies were absolutely convinced they needed to defeat Nazism utterly. But if you look at the later writings of someone like Goebbels, you know, he is utterly convinced that the Allies and the Germans will join up and then continue their war against Soviet Russia. And it was very close. If you imagine that the Cold War breaks out, what, you know, only about a year after the German defeat, and then the enemy is Soviet Russia.
Let's talk again with another caller here, someone where we are in Urbana. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi. I'm wondering whether your guest has looked at the numbers. This has to do with the was feeding Europe immediately after liberation in World War II, compared it with the amount of food that was, say, brought to France, that was brought to, that was given to countries that were, in fact, associated with the Allies or had been persecuted or overrun by the Germans, because I remember myself vividly that relatives in Norway right after the war were writing my family saying, please help us. We don't have food. We need food. Please help us as much as you can. And we sent boxes and boxes of food and clothing to family in Norway, so that I don't have the sense, honestly, that there was a great effort to bring food in, to bring clothing in to some of these countries. And I also would like to take one more issue. The notion that seeing Buchenwald, Auschwitz, as that one was asked to go there to actually see what happened in those camps can be called macabre, is, it seems to me, a way of downplaying the terrible, terrible genocide that happened there, and a way of trivializing it in some way. I may be wrong about this, but that's my sense. Bye.
All right. Well, Mr. McDonough?
Well, the first issue, there are two issues there. I mean, it is obviously true that all of Europe was starving, and Britain too. I mean, there were a lot of talk about why should we feed the Germans when we're starving ourselves. And this was hardly, you know, there was hardly much fat on the carcass here. And indeed, you know, when I was born 10 years after the war, there was still rationing of certain products in this country. So I don't think we should forget that there was a great shortage of food all over Europe, and the supply lines had been cut and took time to reestablish. Also, there was not much money around. Britain was bankrupted, for example, largely by the war. So I think that is true. People said at the time that the Germans have to stand at the end of the queue. But again, going back to what I said earlier about laws of war, it is considered to be one of the laws of war that you have to feed the conquered people. As soon as you they lay down their arms, you have to provide them with food. And those things are actually set down as numbers of calories, so that your conquered people are supposed to be given 2,500 calories a day, which was some level of nutrition that the Allies could not aspire to giving for quite some considerable time. Back to my use of the word macabre, perhaps that was a careless use of a word, but it was certainly seen as part of the trip for prominent visitors to occupied Germany to go off and visit certain places, and Buchenwald being one of them. Whether that was in the caller's mind a necessary thing, or whether it was used with a tinge of cynicism or a tinge of a sense of propaganda, I leave listeners to judge themselves.
All right. We'll get at least one more caller, someone here on a cell phone. This is line 4, the toll-free line. Hello?
Hello. Yes, sir. My name's Thomas Schuler. I just I wanted to comment on I'm 41 years old. I was the first of my family born in these United States. My grandfather, my father was born in Germany, and my uncles, all my great uncles, they all came over here not soon after the war had ended from Germany. And I recall as growing up, and my grandfather actually is still alive and kicking, and but, you know, we're seeing him, he'd sit there and they would watch documentaries and so on, you know, TV. But, you know, I'd hear him talking about how he would cry, you know, that that how isolated they were. And I just want people to understand that, I know your guest here does, because he knows his history well, but that Nazis were like an inner circle. It's almost like they knew the whole agenda to everything that was going on, but the common everyday civilian of Germany or a lot of the soldiers were kept in the dark. That, you know, he's even said as growing up, or even in the when they were in the German forces, that they had radios that were broadcast nothing but stations that came out of Berlin, that they knew nothing of what went on the outside. He said that even when they moved into Austria and then on into Italy, he went down into the Mediterranean region to conquer those areas, that the Nazi commanders would come in and tell his immediate commander that, you know, well, you've got a force that's trying to invade Germany, and we're moving in to stop them. Not that, you know, and what would happen when they would move in is they'd suddenly see these armies in front of them of Italy and so on, ready to challenge them, and all they knew is that they're trying to come into Berlin, that not they were invading. You know, it was so, you know, amazing to hear, you know, all these different things as to how Hitler was actually able to even keep his own people and his own army in the dark as to what was actually going on.
Yeah, I've got to kind of jump in here because we're really at the end of the time. I just want to give the guest an opportunity to, you know, make some kind of comment.
Yes, it wasn't Hitler's nature to allow his people too much knowledge of what they were doing, and propaganda was his forte, and the question of how much the German people were left in the dark about what was going on is one that I'm afraid would take rather longer than we have left to go into. But certainly, you know, there were entirely innocent Germans, let's use that in the broader sense of the word, who had no idea why they were fighting. You know, these are just what we've been talking about all along, how ordinary people get caught up in a war like this and quite often perish, and whether there is any justice in that happening. So it is an interesting question.
Yeah. Well, we will have to stop here because we've come to the end of the time. The book that we've been talking about is After the Reich, The Brutal History of the Allied Occupation. It's recently published by Basic Books by our guest, Giles McDonough. He's also the author of The Last Kaiser, A Life of Wilhelm II and Frederick the Great, as well as histories of both Berlin and Prussia. Mr. McDonough, thank you very much.
Thank you.